Well, I wanted people to care more about the issue. And I wanted people to be better voters when they vote for criminal justice policies. And I wanted people to be better jurors when they get called up for jury duty, to not jump to conclusions based on what's often faulty evidence.
There are over 3,300 documented cases of wrongful convictions in the U.S., and over 25,000 combined years have been lost due to wrongful convictions. Our next guest, Justin Brooks, is a criminal defense lawyer, law professor, and he's the founding director of the California Innocence Project, where he spent decades freeing innocent people from prison. Justin is also the author of the only legal casebook devoted to the topic of wrongful convictions, and the author of You Might Go to Prison Even Though You're Innocent. It's a book that details the causes of wrongful convictions based on his experience for more than three decades as a criminal defense attorney and Innocence Organization director. He's also portrayed by Academy Award-nominated actor Greg Kinnear in the feature film Brian Banks. So I wanted to catch up with Justin about his new book. You know, I think over the years, as somebody who has personally experienced relationships and family members of those that have been incarcerated, I've also had the privilege of working alongside leading organizations that fight every day for legal aid and legal assistance. If you care about the future of work, you're not going to want to miss this conversation. It's an important one. Here's Justin Brooks. Let's bring it in.
Justin, so I guess to kick us off, you know, here's a question you've probably never gotten before. Like, you might go to prison even though you're innocent. Why'd you write the book?
Well, after, you know, 30 years of representing innocent people who've been sent to prison, I just saw this evolution from people just not believing there were innocent people in prison, which is, in the beginning, it was like that, because I started doing this work around the beginnings of DNA before we'd had all those exonerations. And I saw the evolution go from a deep cynicism about anyone being innocent in prison to this notion that, well, you know, innocent people might go to prison, but it'll never happen to me. It'll never happen to my family. So I don't really care. And so what I wanted to show with this book is that, from my experience, and I've been able to free 40 innocent people from prison, that where disproportionately it certainly hits people of color, it hits poor people, it hits people who live in certain neighborhoods, but anybody can be wrongfully convicted. And I wanted to show that, how people like Kimberly Long, who is a middle-class white nurse living in the suburbs, when she came home one night and found her boyfriend beaten to death due to all the flaws in the criminal legal system, she spent 7 years in prison, and that it literally could happen to anybody. And what was my motive for that? Well, I wanted people to care more about the issue. And I wanted people to be better voters when they vote for criminal justice policies. And I wanted people to be better jurors when they get called up for jury duty, to not jump to conclusions based on what's often faulty evidence.
You founded the California Innocence Project. Can you talk to us a little bit about the work you do there?
Sure. Back in 1999, I started the California Innocence Project. I was motivated by a case I'd worked on in Chicago of a 21-year-old woman who was sentenced to death on a plea bargain. And I went and started working on her case, actually met with her on death row after I'd heard about her case, and thought, like, how the hell is anybody sentenced to death on a plea bargain? Like, they've waived their right to trial, they've waived most of their appeals, and what did they get in exchange? The death penalty, which is the worst thing that could have happened if everything had gone wrong in all those processes. And I found this young woman who had just been railroaded by the system. Her lawyer had pled her out, had been given a $10,000 retainer. And for that, he did no investigation into the case and just pled her out. So I recruited some law students at the law school I was teaching at the time in Michigan to work with me on the case. And within a couple of days, by just going to the crime scene, we realized that the key evidence was completely fabricated and she was innocent and about to be executed by the state of Illinois.
You have a ton of powerful stories in the book. I mean, as you go through it, they just kind of stack and build, and they pull you in a lot of different directions emotionally as you're reading it. What's been the feedback you know, for you? I mean, you know, the book's over a year old, right? Or coming up on that. Like, what has been the feedback from folks that, you know, have come back to you after they've read it?
Yeah, I've been really happy with the feedback. I mean, I've had, you know, very good reviews of the book and all that, and that feels good. I haven't had anyone say that it's poorly written, which as a writer, that's good to hear. And since it is sort of a reflection of my life's work, it was extremely personal to me. And so it was important to me that, you know, it was well received. It's been very well received by undergraduate criminal justice professors, which has really made me happy. A bunch of them have adopted it as a textbook in their course, which there's really no bigger compliment than that. You know, someone can pick up a book and spend a few hours reading it and put it down and say that was a good book. But for a professor to integrate it into their syllabus, which was probably already set up long ago, require their students to read it, and then for the professor to have to understand it at a level to teach it, feels really good. I mean, I wish I could be a fly on the wall in the rooms where it's being taught, but that's pretty exciting for me.
And one of the things that I think about is, you know, as you think about, we're obviously talking about future of work topics a lot here. As I read the book, one of the things that jumped off the page to me is how in my journey talking to either HR leaders or talent leaders or C-level executives within organizations, you know, a common challenge that bubbles up is it's really hard to find talent. It's really hard to find workers that will work. It's really hard to find workers with the right skills. And one of the things I thought I was reading the book was, the reality of these lived experiences can have a really lasting effect even beyond, you know, the success you have with some of your clients. Like, I'm interested in hearing, you know, your point of view as these folks transition back into day-to-day life or back into the workforce. Like, what are some, you know, some observations and, you know, what can be surprising to employers who, you know, have a major opportunity to be able to assist in that transition to help folks get, you know, back on the right path, you know, back on path?
Yeah, that's a great question and one that's not asked often enough. I mean, first, let's start with kind of the mistakes that we've made. I mean, this country incarcerates, the United States incarcerates more people than any country in the world. And we also incarcerate the highest percentage of our population than any country in the world. So to put that in perspective, you know, China has 1 billion more people than we do, and we incarcerate more people. And the crazy part about that is every study shows a direct connection between economics and crime, and yet we're the wealthiest country in the world by a lot of measures, and yet we incarcerate more of our population than any other country. So that's crazy to think about. We should be one of the lowest incarcerating countries in the world if things were done right. But we've made a tremendous number of mistakes along the way. And one of them has to do with how we deal with people when they are incarcerated and how we view incarceration as you know, a community, as a country. When you look at Northern Europe and that the low recidivism rate that they have, where we have one of the highest in the world, you know, most people go to prison in the United States, go back to prison within 3 years. And why is that? Well, it's because countries like Northern Europe and countries in Northern Europe realize that prison can be an opportunity, and it can be an opportunity to turn people's lives around in the same way that we think about rehab, for example. You know, we don't lock people up in rehab and then hope for the best when we let them back out that they're not going to use drugs and alcohol. We're trying to use that time out of society to change the way they think about drugs and alcohol and try to reduce the chances they're going to use again. But we don't do that with our correctional system because we're so focused not on corrections, even though it's called a correctional system, but we're so focused on punishment and we're so angry and politics play into it. And we're seeing a whole new cycle of it again in this, you know, presidential election with crime's out of control. We need more police. We need longer prison sentences. We need this and that. We keep doubling down on this mistake over and over and over again. So what's the result for employment? Like, how does that impact in the long run? Well, first of all, because we don't focus on education and training when people are incarcerated, they don't necessarily have any more education or training when they get out. And now when they get out, they've got no more education, no more training. They've probably developed some bad habits along the way because of the way prison is structured, where things are taking care of you to a certain extent so that you have difficulty taking care of yourself. And now they got a black mark on their record that they've been to prison, which makes it really difficult to get a job. And you see even more severe cases like my client, Brian Banks, which is probably my most famous client, where there was a movie made about his story, where in his case, they then put an ankle monitor on him and tell him, okay, go get a job, but you have to tell your employer that for 2 hours a day, you have to sit next to a socket and recharge it. You got to tell your employer that you're on parole and a parole officer is going to come around and check on you. You got to tell your employer you're not allowed to go to certain places. You can't, like in California, if you're a convicted sex offender, you can't be in parks. All our beaches are parks. You can't go near the beach again. You can't live near a park. You can't live near a school. So we keep doubling down on these things that make it more and more difficult for people to go through the system, come out and be successful, which then ultimately benefits all of us, that we have this mass of young workers that become unemployable. And as those numbers get into the millions, it's significant. And it's the one crystal clear black mark on your record. Like, for example, I talked about rehab earlier. I mean, you can go to rehab, you can have serious addiction problems. That's up to you whether an employer is going to know about that. And they could assess you and say, like, whether this person is going to be a good worker or not. But prison has become the ultimate black mark, the ultimate, this is not somebody to take a chance on. And it hurts all of us in the end of the day.
Yeah. My father and my brother were in prison. I remember very clearly being 16, 17, and my father was trying to, access job training while behind the wall, which is not the easiest, even to this, like we know. I mean, data shows like the majority of people behind the wall are not getting access to job training, you know, while they're being quote corrected. And I remember like going to the library, like printing off the CDL trucker exam certifications and like putting them in the mail and sending them. Sometimes they got through, sometimes they didn't. And I just remember like sticks with me to this day of all the lost time, things like that could be occurring, that weren't.
That's a perfect example. So here you go. Now we have to rely on that. We've got family members that have the aptitude and the care to then go out and make these things happen for people who are incarcerated because the system ignores it. And I love you say, you know, the lost opportunity, lost time, because that's something I preach about all the time, that prison can be this tremendous opportunity. My wife and I started 30 years ago in the DC prison, a family literacy program. And the idea was we taught the incarcerated parents how to teach their children to read. And once a week, we'd round these children up all around the city of DC and bring them to the prison. And we got the prison school to set up a big room with toys and books. And we bring the kids in there and the parents in there and have the parents teach them how to read. And it had a lot of great things about it. One was to try to break the cycle of illiteracy within the families. Another thing was to get connected between these parents and their children in a positive way with a positive activity instead of sitting in the visiting hall arguing about bills and all the things that kind of happen in that process. And it was just such a simple, basic thing because we were thinking like, you know, how do we bring people back into their families? You know, you've experienced it personally, so I don't have to preach to you about it, but like prison isolates people from their families. I have clients that, you know, in California, we could care less, and really anywhere in the United States, about these families because the U.S. Supreme Court has said you can be incarcerated anywhere in the United States once you're incarcerated. So you can get incarcerated in New Jersey and they can ship you out to Alabama. They can ship you out to Seattle. obviously we don't care about the families, or we wouldn't do that. You know, in California, most of the incarcerated people come from Los Angeles, yet we've got prisons that are like at the northern border of California. And like, I can get to Bolivia quicker than I can get to some of these prison facilities. And it's all these kinds of things that all combine to make people less functional, less connected to their families, less to come home to, less trained to come home. And then on top of it, there's things like we lead the world in solitary confinement. And every study says that solitary confinement causes mental damage, serious mental damage, PTSD, all kinds of problems. Yet I get clients that get locked down 30 days for small things in solitary confinement when we know that is going to be so contrary to their rehabilitation and the notion that they're going to get out and be okay. And so it's just, it's not talked about enough. It's not focused on. And, you know, I hope your dad ended up doing okay. He's very lucky that he had a son that cared enough and had the wherewithal to try help in some way. Yeah. But that's not how it should be.
Right. Yeah. It's wild. You know, we have some friends that do a lot of advocacy work in the DC. You mentioned DC and in the DC court system, and do a lot of work with one organization specifically does a lot of work with young people who are incarcerated. And as you know, with DC not having statehood, you go into the federal system and you go all over the country. And then, there's an organization we work with that advocates to make sure that young people continue to have access to education while behind the wall, because that's a major challenge coming back to like lost opportunity and lost time. If you're 16 or 17 years old, you're putting a crazy burden on a young person when they do return to try to catch up.
You know, it's interesting you bring up DC in that context, because DC used to be the best place to do our programs and now is the worst place. Because when I lived in DC, we did have a prison, Lorton Prison. And Lorton Prison was where everybody was kept. It was 22 miles from DC. So it was the easiest place in the country to visit, to do programming, because you had everybody from the city right there within short driving distance. And then they closed Lorton Prison. And as you say, now they're spread out throughout the system. Now it's the absolute worst place in the country in terms of you get incarcerated, you could end up in Hawaii, where your family's gonna have to, you know, buy an $800 plane ticket to come visit you. It's just crazy.
I mean, we could do a whole different podcast talking about the revenue model behind prison, which is it really starts to make your stomach churn. I guess, you know, question for you, Justin, to the manager that's listening, like to the frontline manager at a grocery store, or to the recruiter that works inside of a big retail brand who's hiring, or to the C-level executive who sets talent policy and what does the new talent from interviewing to review to selection to training development, to that person that's listening and hopefully reading your book, what are some like specific action steps you feel that private sector companies can take to better create a world where all people have access, regardless of record, to the opportunities they need to be successful?
Well, it's got to start with not making that an automatic no, that someone's been to prison, and trying to assess this individual person in terms of whether they're going to be a good worker. And I think it also starts with changing the notion about who it is who goes to prison. You know, we have all these constant horror stories, and you know, people used to tell me when I worked in the prison, they'd say like, oh, do you feel unsafe in there? And I'd say, you know what? In the District of Columbia, one of the safest places I feel is in the prison, because there's been a metal detector. People have been searched. Like, I worked in there for years without any incidents whatsoever. But I think people think that prisons are filled with violent people. They automatically equate a prison record with violence. And that's just not true. The overwhelming majority of people in prison are in there for nonviolent offenses. And the main reason our prisons filled was the war on drugs that was launched by Richard Nixon. And so when you look at the numbers and the increase and the exponential increase in incarceration, it's been mostly due to the war on drugs. And so is it true that prisons have a lot of people with drug and alcohol problems? Absolutely. Are there a lot of people in prison who come from poverty? Absolutely. So let's talk about that and what people have done to address that and what is their current situation and what are the things that they did to better themselves in prison if they had any opportunities to do that. And I just think it's as simple as assessing people the same way they would anyone else, because everybody's got stuff in their background. The unfortunate thing is people who've been to prison, it's just this clear stamp thing on your forehead, whereas all the other messed up stuff that people do or have wrong with them, nobody knows. So, you know, it's kind of like I used to tell my kids when they first had those sex offender registries were out and, you know, the whole country's up in arms and there's all these private websites. I said to my kids, look, treat everybody like a convicted sex offender. Just don't go in anybody's house. Don't get in anybody's van. You know, just come home after school. And don't talk to anybody. So I just think it's more wiping that out of our head that being incarcerated means this, because it just doesn't. We don't know what people are like until we look closer at them. That's what I'd say to employers, to government agencies. I'd say we got to stop the madness of making it more and more difficult for people to get employment. It's got to be something like, why should, for instance, people have to disclose sometimes arrest records? That's the one that pisses me off the most. Just because you've been arrested in the United States of America and not convicted, all that means is some police officer thought you did something, and then later on the system decided you didn't. And yet arrest records have to be reported. So it's all just putting the scarlet letter on people, and it's largely meaningless. Because if somebody had a drug and alcohol problem and they've addressed it, then that's the person I want over someone who may have an ongoing drug and alcohol problem that hasn't been arrested by any way, hasn't been stopped, and hasn't been addressed. So it's just take a closer look, give people an opportunity to prove who they are. Employers really can help us dig our way out of this problem, at least the recidivism problem, because I understand sometimes why people come back. They get out, they don't have opportunities, they're completely disconnected from their family, and they just stop caring, which is just, you know, human nature. As at a certain point, failure just gets to people to the point of they just stop trying, and we could all help in that.
Yeah. Justin, final question. I appreciate you taking time. You know, we're talking obviously the effects and the topics related to your book have a direct impact on, you know, the future of work, which is obviously a topic that comes up very often and is coming up more often, even in 2024, as we think about the effects of automation, robots, AI, ChatGPT, you name it, right? These things are all affecting, you know, what we look at as work and the future of work. What is your hope for the future of work?
Well, you know, I running law offices is a unique thing. And I think, you know, what's crazy is, and I actually haven't said this out loud or in public before, but COVID actually really helped my work in a lot of meaningful ways. Like, obviously it was a horrible thing. So many people died. It's absolutely one of the worst things of my lifetime in terms of our community and everything else. But in terms of getting innocent people out of prison, my lawyers were at home grinding out cases. There was huge amount of pressure on the government to get people out of prison. The governor of California freed four of my clients with clemency, cases that I'd banged my head against the wall to try to get them to notice for a long time. And we were able to be extremely productive working remotely and getting things done. So I think the future of work will be that level of flexibility of people being able to use their skills and be flexible in their work and working remotely is part of that. But as somebody, you know, in their late 50s, who still has in their head what the workplace is supposed to look like, it's a tough adjustment for us. I can tell you, I've got employees, I have a receptionist now who talks about, you know, working remotely. And I say, well, how are you going to receive people remotely? You know, but it's a tough thing because you have the lawyers not coming in every day. And then all of a sudden this poor person's got to sit at the front desk and see everybody working from home and thinking, you know, they're probably home watching TV, making a nice lunch, having this nice life. So I think we're starting to see now that sort of like, oh, separation of employees, those that can, you know, move to Puerto Vallarta and work remotely, and those who can't. So that's a whole new sort of segregation thing, I think, that employers are having to deal with. But, you know, I hope, like everyone, that the future of work involves a better work-life balance. You know, if you look in the long run, when you go back to the 1700s, 1600s, we certainly have moved in a good direction from 7 days a week of working, from no labor laws, you know, to a period of time now. But I think we could do better in terms of that. But it's a challenge, I can tell you, as a boss. It's a challenge to be thinking about how can I give flexibility, still get coverage for the things we need coverage for, and not make some people in the group feel left out of that because their positions are just so much more difficult to make flexible.
Totally. Justin, love your work. Appreciate you taking time to talk to us today.
My pleasure. And people can check out my book. It's on Amazon.com. You Might Go to Prison Even Though You're Innocent.
Great. Thanks, Justin.
Take care.
Ton of takeaways from the conversation with Justin. I really enjoyed the conversation. You know, if we're going to create a future of work where everybody can participate and everybody can compete, which ultimately is really critical if we're going to fully realize the opportunities of our society and our community, you know, we have to consider the way that we treat our most vulnerable. And we also have to consider how we treat people and how our justice system treats others. You know, Justin said he wanted to write the book to enlighten people that anyone can be wrongly incarcerated. And wow, is that true? All of us can think back to a moment in time where maybe we just weren't caught. And the reality is, as Justin said, the overwhelming majority of people who are in prison are there for nonviolent offenses. And I think this is a really important topic area for business leaders, for frontline managers, for coworkers to be aware of, to shine a light on. Because again, as you show up to work every day, as you engage with workers, as you go through your day-to-day life, understanding that their lived experience may have been one where they came through a experience of incarceration, even though they are innocent, is critical if you really are trying to create a workplace environment and a community where everybody can participate. In his book, Justin says that surviving prison as an innocent person is a surreal nightmare that nobody wants to think about. And, you know, he says, it can happen to anybody. If you haven't read it, coming out of this conversation, I highly encourage you to go on over and pick up at your local bookstore Justin Brooks' book, You Might Go to Prison Even Though You're Innocent. It shouldn't just be essential reading for anyone interested in criminal justice reform. It should be essential reading for everybody. So thanks to Justin for your work. Thank you for joining us and making time to have this conversation. Now don't forget to subscribe to Bring It In so you never miss an episode. We've got some awesome guests lined up that you're not going to want to miss. Now, back to work.